This is KHBR, the voice of darkness for the intrepid travelers of the left-hand path. I'm Magister Robert Adams, your host. We'll be accompanying you on your journey. So get ready, sit back, relax, and prepare to kefir and remanifest. Welcome to KHBR, the voice of darkness. I'm Magister Robert Adams, and today, rather appropriately, the day after Valentine's Day, we will be talking about sex magic. And with me back once again is Magister Mark Luskin. Mark, I'm glad to have you back. I think this is going to be a good show for us today.
Glad to be back.
Now, we were talking about this yesterday, and we thought one of the best things to do would be to start off by reading the Category 13, Sex in Religion and Magic, comments by Dr. Michael Aquino and Don Webb that they had to set a sort of background as to what the Temple of Set thinks about regarding sex magic. So I'll start first with Dr. Aquino's, and that's, sex and magic have never been very far apart. This is both because sorcerers and sorceresses tend to be rather sensual individuals, and because the sexual drives, as distinct from sex per se, can be used for purposes of ritual magic. Historically, black magical societies have been accused of being obsessed with sex. A black magician might well retort that his or hers is the rational and mature approach, and that the critic is suffering from a bad case of Judeo-Christian repressed sex neurosis hysteria. A problem with sex magic has been that many practitioners, in an effort to overcompensate for the aforementioned neurosis, have plunged into sex in the most animalistic way possible, as an indulgence for its own sake. This, for example, with the presumption of the Church of Satan, or excuse me, was the presumption of the Church of Satan. Aleister Crowley, however, employed his sexual magic practices as a means to attain an ecstatic state of being appropriate to an ulterior conceptualized goal, a fact that almost totally is lost on his latter-day disciples, who more often than not either ignore the sexual component in his workings or become obsessed with it. The Temple of Set proposes an integral, non-compulsive, comfortable, and relaxed inner relationship between sex, aesthetics, and love, the neglect of any one of which will inhibit the efficacy of whatever magical working is involved. And Don Webb adds to this, the only commandment here is to know yourself. Whether you choose to overcome boundaries or practice what you know, whether you choose a lot, a little, or none, your practice of safe, sane, consensual adult sexuality must be absolutely and ultimately your own. Let your sense of beauty, which is to say, Ma'at, be your guide. So that gives you a sort of small synopsis of how the Temple of Set approaches sex magic. And this is something that...
And I think there's some really important ideas that are in there, too. One of which is the key notion that this is something that's integrated into your initiation. It's not the focus of it. It's not the ultimate weapon in it. It's one part of the larger initiatory process.
Right. And also, I think the fact that, you know, we're separating ourselves from the way other people, you know, Dr. Aquino gives the examples of the way the Church of Satan, you know, using the naked female on the altar. Aleister Crowley with his 3 degrees in the OTO, the 8th, 9th, and 11th, which are all sexually based. It's just a part of what we do. It's not everything that we do. And the few members that I have met who had a really big focus on sex magic ended up not lasting too long. You know, they were the people that came to the crowd thinking we were like, had all these naked Roman-style orgies. And when they found out that we didn't, they were like, oh, well.
Oh, well, you didn't get the invite?
I did. It's just, they didn't get it.
Okay.
Now, because Valentine's Day was yesterday, I happen to read something, and this is something we had been talking about, that Saint Valentine's Day was put into place by a pope to sort of cover up what was going on during the Lupercalia, where supposedly they were saying that single women would put their names in a jar or a pot, and all the bachelors would go and draw their name out, and they would then be together for a year, which sometimes led to marriage, sometimes not. If it didn't, then they would do it again, I guess, next year. Now, when we were talking, you were mentioning how what people used to think, and like I mentioned, did the Victorian morality kill sex and impose these very moralistic things on everyone? And you mentioned, well, some people are taking a look at that now. And
yeah, well, I think there's two different issues that happen. One of which is that, you know, no culture can suddenly turn sexuality off. It's a part of human nature, and I think that there's a tendency to think that somehow during the Victorian period, someone had hit a button and sexuality had been erased, and then it re-erupted sometime afterwards. Which, if you look at a lot of what Victorian culture was like, it really doesn't play into, you know, what we know about it from the kind of street prostitution that was happening and everything else. But the other thing is that when a lot of people have looked at various historical periods and what the sexual practices were, it's tough sometimes to tell what's really there and what's people projecting ideas onto this. And you find that a lot with ideas like temple prostitution, which was thought to have been practiced in areas in the Near East, or various other forms of sacred prostitution. And I think part of the problem with that is that, for the most part, these were male researchers who were looking at this material, and the only roles that they could think of in their mind that women could play in any religion was either as cloistered virgins, similar to contemporary nuns, or fantasy sex objects. Yeah. That seems to be the only two things, and, you know, it's this kind of very, you know, infantile or adolescent notion of what women are capable of, which unfortunately you still see carried into a lot of popular occultism today, whether it's the giant mommy goddess or the, you know, the ultimate stripper fantasy figure that comes out of certain organizations. We'll just leave it at that.
Yeah, yeah. And actually what really surprised me that I learned about, I mean, you know, I was born in the 60s, so I got to see all the free love that was going on in the 60s, and sex was rampant everywhere. And I remember in this sex education, it was Variations on Human Sexuality, that was probably the best and easiest 3 units I ever took in college. And they basically showed. Right.
Yeah, that seems to be, unfortunately, where a lot of people get their sex education from, are these kind of easy A classes in college or high school.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, the only difference was in college is basically you would go for 3 hours a week and sit there and watch porn movies. When they were showing this old movie about sex from the 60s, you know, you had all these people with, like, you know, herpes sores on themselves, and they didn't understand the safe sex practices. And then I found out that in the Roaring Twenties there was a very big free love movement as well. And I think a lot of
people, not just in the States, I think around the world, and even the 19th century, there was a lot of the various health fads that gave rise to a lot of our contemporary health fads, included a lot of free love movements, you know, extreme vegetarianism, communalism. A lot of the ideas that people think of as being, you know, somehow 60s ideas sort of come from the middle of the 19th century. And strangely, a lot of it comes from upstate New York, although it all found its home in California.
Yeah, well. Well, yeah, it's California. That's going to happen here.
Yeah, no, there's a wonderful book on this. I don't know if you've ever read it, but there's a fellow by the name of Eric Davis who wrote, it's a compendium of photography that a friend of his did, but he provided a lot of the words to it, which is called Visionary State, about the way that California became this home for a lot of these strange ideas. But in the course of it, you start noticing that most of these strange ideas start off in New York and find their way to California.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's a particular kind of trajectory that happened in the 19th century of these various movements starting on one coast and slowly moving west and eventually coalescing in California and leading to a lot of the boundary pushing qualities that California culture has.
Yeah, and you know, it's just one of these things that there was a few months ago that. There's, I can't remember the name of the organization, but it's essentially a group here in San Francisco where couples go to and they're learning more about intimacy and, you know, sex is like on everyone's brain, it seems like, around here. And, I mean, sex in itself is a magical act. I mean, you can't just sort of, you know, I am going to have an orgasm. And have one.
Well, yeah, it combines all sorts of, you know, will and desire, and, you know, physical activities and anything that one of the interesting features of the human psyche is that we can put meaning onto anything.
Oh, yeah.
And I think one of the areas that humanity's put a lot of meaning on has been the area of sex and sexuality and sensuality, that these are things that are natural processes that we've brought these unnatural notions of things like the sacred to them. And, you know, unfortunately, we often forget that we're the source of these things. This doesn't come down from on high. It comes from our own psyches. And, you know, the things that we build, we start worshiping, and that often leads to problems.
Yeah, and, you know, it's one of these things that, I mean, you know, everyone loves sex. So, I mean, well, at least I would think everyone would.
Except the people who have pathological fears of it.
Yeah. But when you're doing a sex magic ritual, the people are building up this energy, this sexual energy. And, you know, it reminds me of when I was younger, some of the guys who were into the occult. And they were saying, oh, yeah, we did this great ritual and we raised this power. And there was all this energy going around the room and the hair on the back of my neck was standing up. And I'm like, okay, now what did you do with it? You know, so let's talk about why you would use sex in a ritual. We can understand, but what would you try and accomplish? I mean, do you think it would be a good idea to create a sex magical ritual to cause prosperity to come to you?
Well, I think, you know, people will use different methods for their own reasons. I mean, I think that there is a little bit of a, you know, a lot of times much of contemporary sex magic practices come out of places like Theodore Royce's original version of the Ordo Templi Orientis, or OTO, and get a lot of that gets filtered through Crowley and pushed out through a lot of different sources. And a lot of the core idea there involves, you know, visualization during the sexual act, sexual completion, and sort of talismanic use of the sexual fluids as a result. There may be something to it. On another level, it seems a little silly. You know, someone who was actually very well versed in this practice was the late Dr. Christopher Hyatt, who is a publisher of books like Undoing Yourself with Energized Meditation and had been one of the publishers of New Falcon Press. And he had a very dismissive attitude towards a lot of this at the end of his life. You know, there are some interviews that have been released by New Falcon and the other publisher of his works now, Original Falcon. And it's a very interesting kind of thing to see this sort of dismissive attitude towards a lot of that from someone who was, you know, trained in this from Israel Regardi. And I think for part of the reason he had this attitude, matches some of my own feelings on this, is that there's a certain so what quality to all of it.
Right.
You know, and don't get me wrong, it's great. People should be able to have, you know, whatever kind of sexual expression they find. And if they want to put symbolic elements around it, that's great, if it deepens the experience for them. But those things don't inherently change who you are. They're not necessarily self-transformative. And Hyatt was more interested in this self-transformative possibilities of sexuality.
Okay, I can see that. I mean, while you were talking, I was thinking of a couple of rituals that I had read about, and you know, sometimes they become so complex. There's one in the book Fire and Ice, and you know this one is the couple is basically having sex, and it's like when the man orgasms, the woman has to reach around and stick his finger in her in his anus while someone else cuts the head off a chicken and lets the blood rain down on them. And I'm like,
yeah, it was the one of the Pent Alpha degree rites, the 18th degree in the Fraternitas Saturni and one of its later iterations. There's some questions about whether or not that particular ritual was ever really part of the Fraternitas Saturni's material, or if it was something that one of the members kind of added to the internus set. You know, that it's an interesting thing. There are versions of it that are also other versions of it, some in the original German floating around on the web. And there is this kind of very complicated, over-the-top thing that people sometimes like doing, not just with sex magic, with magic in general. You know, sure. All this heavily choreographed, you know, song and dance, Busby Berkeley type numbers that they want to do.
Yeah, I mean, the DEV, the Die Elektrischen Vorspiele, is a perfect example of that. And you know, it takes a lot of work to pull something like that off. But I mean, you know, for a couple to be having sex and, you know, you have, and then at this moment you do this and then you do this. And, I think you would need a lot of Viagra to be able to keep up with it. You know, it's just way too complex.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of people that want, you know, I think I had said this to you once before. It's like, you know, no one's ever gone broke telling other people what to do with their sex lives.
Well, yeah, that's true.
And part of it's because, you know, sex is something of a mysterious thing. It comes out of the pre-personal drives of your body. There are other factors that go into the way that your personal sexuality manifests that I think is often very mysterious and for some people very frightening. And so they want something big and elaborate. They want somebody to tell them step by step what they should do with their sexuality. And I think, you know, as you talked about workshops and things like that, I think the big push behind a lot of workshops on sex and sexual expression come out of this confusion that people have by their sex drives. You know, this unknown thing, and they just want someone to explain it to them, or better yet, explain it away for them.
Yeah, and there was a board I was on once. I'm not going to mention their name because I haven't been there in a while, so I have no idea how good they are but anymore. But someone was talking about sex magic, and, you know, someone wanted an example. And there was this guy who, I can't remember what his rationale was, but he would basically masturbate while doing things unrelated to the masturbating. And he would usually incorporate things into it that would normally, that were his fears, basically. And he said at one point, he said, and then I decided to masturbate while holding a small turd under my nose because I had a real difficult time with bad smells and feces. And I found after I ejaculated that I no longer had this problem. And I was like, okay, that's a little out there.
Well, there's a use of you know, Skinner style operant conditioning.
Yeah.
I think there's a lot of people come up with a lot of odd things to do with their sexuality, which I think if you spent any time on the internet, you learn that pretty quickly. Right. You know, the internet's been this wonderful little pipeline into the human psyche to some extent, in that so much of it's about advertising peculiar ideas and all the most unusual forms of human sexuality.
Well, and, you know, one of the things, I did this kind of as a joke on one of the past shows, is each show lets you put tags. And just for the heck of it, on one of the shows, I put the tag midget porn. And my software shows me, like, what words people were using to find the site. And still, to this day, one of the top words people use to find that come to the site is midget porn. So I mean, there's this fixation that some people have
Well, you know, there's no reason that little people can't pursue kefir as well. I mean,
that's true.
You know, it's an odd way to branch to this, but you know, we had talked about the idea that one of the interesting things about the temple is that we really don't care what people's sexual lives or gender identities, any of these various markers, provided it's, you know, as Ipsissimus as Webb had said, you know, as long as it's safe, sane, consensual, and adult sexual activity, we don't really worry too much about it. You know, you're on your own for determining what your needs and desires are and finding the ways of fulfilling them.
Yeah, and that reminds me of something we were talking about, because I met someone, his name is Buck Angel, and he is a female-to-male transsexual. And the thing is going from male to female is a lot easier than going from female to male, because...
Yeah, there hasn't been as much research, and the methodology has been a lot more complicated.
Yeah, and the whole idea of creating a penis from whatever body material you have to work with doesn't really work as well. And so,
yeah, phalloplasty, which is the term for it, is still relatively experimental. They haven't really been doing that many of them, and most of the results haven't been that great.
And so Buck still has a vagina, basically. And when you see this guy, you would never think that he was a woman. I mean, he's a little shorter than me, but he is way more buffed than me. And, you know, we were sitting there talking, and at one point he goes, "You so totally get it." You know, because, I mean, how people identify themselves, it's not entirely male, not entirely female, not entirely heterosexual or homosexual. And there are ways that people can do this. And, I mean, you know, they fall somewhere in between. And, I mean, as far as self-transformation, I mean, having a sex change has got to be like one of the ultimate body modification, self-transformation things
absolutely.
You can do.
I mean, you're no longer just hacking with the kind of cultural material that we often mess around with the idea of antinomianism, of, you know, going against custom. You know, these are people the need for them to make radical core carnal level changes in their being based upon the fulfillment of their needs and desires. I mean, that's a tremendous thing. And I think that it's one of those things that Setians who've spent enough time, you know, dealing with people and the kind of work that we do, there's always an open door to people that have gone to those kinds of extremes that they've needed, which I think that sometimes takes other people aback who prefer this kind of very intellectual approach to issues of self-transformation.
Yeah. Yeah, because I know also, my best friend growing up, he always had a bit of a problem being a guy. And, you know, one of the weirdest things is when I met him, he was 14 and he had a full beard and mustache. And now he's in his early 40s, and he went through the counseling and then started the transition, and now he's had a full sex change to become a female, and he's now, I mean, when I see him, he's much more happier who she is now than who he was before. And
right,
you know, this is something, I mean, we've had a few people who've been transsexuals in the temple. And the funny thing to me was that I didn't even know that they were until they told me. And, you know, I just
right.
thought, oh, I just thought you were...
Well, that's where, you know, there's certain variations too. You know, you have people, we've got the biological characteristics of sex that are keyed to things like XY chromosomes and the variations that happen there. Because there are, you know, people with 2X chromosome, 2Y chromosome. There are other conditions that can happen of intersex. And then you've got that whole layer of culture that determines so much about gender, and that a lot of people don't fit those particular cultural suggestions very well. And it's part of how a lot of societies have controlled people, is this idea that because we're never quite perfect to what we're told we're supposed to be, the utilization of the guilt because of that imperfection was how people were kept in line.
Yeah.
You know, you don't quite match it. You don't want anyone else to find out that you don't, you're not what you're supposed to be. And so this becomes something that, you know, builds all kinds of other problems. And we live in an interesting time where a lot of this can finally be pushed aside and said, you know what, who I am and who I need to be is more important than what's being expected of me. And, you know, technologies are there to allow people to do all kinds of advanced changes. There's, you know, methodologies for, and primarily what the temple's been interested in are methodologies for undoing some of the damage that, you know, these imposed structures do to the psyche. I think there's a lot of very interesting, you know, explorations that are being done in this and on a variety of levels.
Oh, yeah. Well, and, you know, even I suppose I would call this a sex magic ritual. Even though a lot of people would have trouble seeing it, but one of our group one day decided that he liked the idea of a kilt so much he wanted to get one, but he didn't want the typical Scottish kilt with the tartan on it. So he got an American-made kilt, and he spent a lot of money and got a leather kilt. And he was saying, you know, this is really comfortable. You should try it. And I went out and I got a kilt, and I'm like sitting there in this, and I'm like thinking, God, this makes so much sense. You know, I mean, the, what they call non-bifurcated garments, you know, but just, I went out.
That sounds like one of those terms that you'd find from an anthropologist.
Yeah. And the whole thing with it was, is, you know, at first I would wear it around the house. Then I'd like go in the backyard when I was gardening and I'd wear it. And then I finally went out. I actually went to an OTO. Oh God, it's slipping my mind. The mass they do.
The Gnostic mass?
Yeah, the Gnostic mass. And I actually wore it to a Gnostic mass, and we had to actually take the BART train there. And it was really funny because at first I was feeling a little apprehensive, and then I got on the train and I noticed some people were looking at me like, why is that guy in a skirt? And then someone came up to me and said, you know, they had their, actually, it was when we got off, we're walking down the street and there's this elderly man with his daughter behind him. And he says, now, Kylie, do you notice the man in front of us? He's wearing something different. And I'm like, oh God. I've got a Scotsman behind me. And he says, now, Kylie, do you know what that is he's wearing? That's called a kilt. And I said, it's an American kilt. And he says, is it really? And, you know, we stopped and we talked to him for a little bit. And I suddenly realized that, you know, it was such a freeing experience for me, and it was something that, you know, I overcame basically. And I mean, now, you know, the utilikilts, you see them all over the place. People are wearing them, and want to be different. And you know, something like that is a very simple act of sexual magic, redefining your personality. That's I feel good enough about myself as a man that I'm putting on a kilt. I'm not hiding the fact that it's a skirt, or that if a woman wore it, they would say it's a skirt by calling it a kilt. But still, you know, fine. You want to say I've got a skirt on? I've got a skirt on then. But to me, it was just, it was a very liberating sort of experience by doing this. And, you know, I always, when I attend Conclave, I always have the kilt there, and, you know, I always wear it a few days just to now get the reaction out of people. And
right. Well, I think there's a lot to experimenting with cultural expectations and trying to move beyond them, you know, experimenting with different things and finding, you know, proper ways to experiment with it in contexts that are appropriate to your life and things. But that, you know, a lot of times pushing those kinds of boundaries, trying something that, you know, maybe makes you a little bit uncomfortable, and this really applies, I think, across the board, including in topics of sex.
Oh, yeah.
To see, you know, to learn that a lot of the things that you expect of yourself or that you've come to accept about your own identities and behaviors are somewhat arbitrary. You know, if there's, as long as the stuff that you're engaging in isn't, you know, dangerous to yourself or to others, give it a try. You know, there's all sorts of different means and outlets for alternate fashion approaches, different ideas, different places to that have either very strict or very open, you know, customs of communication. There's lots of opportunities to try on different personas or different things to see what works for you and what doesn't.
Yeah, and I would say that's definitely true. And something I wanted to touch on a bit, because historically over the years, people have gone to sorcerers and wizards to get that secret potion, the aphrodisiac that's, you know, going to make a woman fall over backwards and with her legs spread and screaming, mm-hmm. "Do me." Now, let's let everyone know right now, aside from Viagra and Cialis, which aren't really aphrodisiacs, they're more erectile dysfunction killers, so you can have an erection. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, things like Spanish fly and all the other junk, those are really dangerous.
Yeah, most of the stuff that was marketed as aphrodisiacs either don't work at all or have really marginal success rates. A lot of it's cultural expectation, and less so than it is anything pharmacological.
Yeah, and you know, I had a friend who tried Spanish fly once, and she said, you know, it just made her groin burn and itch. And it's like, you know, if okay, yeah, I guess the only way you could scratch that itch would be to have sex. But, you know, that's not exactly a good way to make you want to have sex. And
No.
I mean, culturally, I have a TV show that I started watching that I love called Bizarre Foods. And Andrew Zimmern, he travels around the world eating just the most god-awful, disgusting things. And it seems like in every culture they have one food that, you know, they say, oh, yeah, you eat this. This is our Viagra, you know. And in some cases, you know, there's seafood like the conch that is high in zinc. So there might be something about that that helps.
Right.
But, you know, just be healthy.
You know, a lot of times people's diets are questionable in most traditional, you know, circumstances. There's, you know, either too much or too little fats and proteins and other problems in people's diets. So the need to have, you know, the idea that there are certain foods that are magic for your wang.
Yeah.
It becomes very popular. And like, if you look around, I mean, there are tons of, you know, in addition to the kind of pharmaceutical level erectile dysfunction things, there's all kinds of crazy ideas about, you know, what you can take to improve your sex life, or, you know, these various kind of, you know, Greekery built around, you know, improving your erections and the like. And it's a kind of an interesting obsession that people have.
Yeah, it definitely is. And it always seems to be aimed at men more than women. Although I did read something where a lower doses of Viagra do increase a woman's libido. You know,
yeah, there's been a fair bit of research to see whether they can get the labeling changed on Viagra.
But I mean, for the most part, you know, if you're trying to get something to have a better sex life, the first thing you should do is, you know, look at your diet. Don't smoke or drink too much, that kind of thing. And, I mean,
figure out what you're into, find other people that are into it.
Yeah. Yeah. Because definitely, you know, I was talking with a friend of mine and I said, anything you can dream up for a fetish that you type into Google, someone will have a website for it. And, you know, there are all these things that you can do. I mean, especially the BDSM community. I mean, they have a very sort of self-transformative approach to what they do. well, not all of them, but a lot of them. And, you know, there are people that...
Well, I think that that's one of those fields that attracts, like a lot of areas, you know, that deal overtly with sexuality. It attracts two different types of people. It attracts some people who have sort of pre-normal attitudes towards sexuality. They've got certain pathologies they're trying to work out and things like that. And there are other folks who have this kind of trans-normal attitude. You know, they've figured out what all the normal expectations of sex are, and they're trying to do the advanced class version of it.
Right.
And of course that creates conflicts because, you know, the pre-normals and the trans-normals find each other and they both think they're part of the same group because they're not normal. And that usually leads to problems.
Yeah, and you know, something else that I just thought of is I've actually known people who will do a sex act that isn't considered normal for, say, a man to do or a woman to do. Mm-hmm. You know, women have gone and bought strap-ons and basically had anal sex with men. And
really? You don't say?
Yeah, you know. Gee, you know, I mean, 5 years ago, if you said pegging, I wouldn't have known what the hell you were talking about. But I didn't even know it had a name. But I mean,
this I'm trying to think. 5 years ago, it may not have. That was a Dan Savageism.
And you know, there are things like this that people are using to overcome fears or discover more about themselves. Mm-hmm. So you know, I can see sex magic being used for this aspect. It's something, though, that I think people can become too into, and you just have to, you know, indulgence instead of abstinence, but, you know, keep in mind moderation. You know, you don't want to basically lock yourself in a room with, you know, 100 porn movies, just watching them all day and pulling on your wang.
Yeah, that sounds like a good way to get chafed and needing to see a doctor.
Yeah.
Well, I think a lot of times, too, is that part of almost one of the problems that happens is that there are a lot of different ways that sexuality can play into your life and initiation. And not all of them are magical in the kind of traditional sense of that term. You know, it doesn't have to be, you know, rituals and things like that, but, you know, the exploration of what your desires are, the learning about how your personal sexuality works, these can be really integral to the larger scale of your initiation work versus that kind of really narrow set of behaviors that usually get lumped in as sex magic. And I think that maybe that's part of the, you know, the where some people get obsessed with this is they think that, you know, all sexuality has to get channeled into some sort of magical practice in a formal sense. And it seems like largely a pretty big waste of time and something that could be, you know, your sexuality could be more interestingly explored in other ways.
Yeah, definitely so. And, you know, I think we've covered a lot of ground here today. Let's see, we did the historical, we did the aphrodisiacs, didn't work, try something new.
Both of us are pretty good at rambling, so yeah. If you just kind of give us a topic and let us talk, we'll cover all sorts of things.
Well, and, you know, I think because sex is one of those things that is just, I mean, when you look at people having sex, it's just there's something kind of funny about the whole act itself. So I think the best way to end this show is on a joke. Now, a guy goes to his doctor and he says, "Doc, I have a problem." And the doctor says, "What's the problem?" And the guy drops his pants and he goes, "Look, my penis is orange." And the doctor says, "Well, that's odd. What do you do?" He goes, "You know, have you done anything different?" He goes, "No, I do what I always do. I sit home and watch porn and eat Cheetos."
That's an awful joke, but probably the best way to leave.
Well, I actually have another one that involves the devil, if you want me to cut that one out and put this one in. It's a little long, but the payoff's really good.
I should go with that one, too.
Okay, well, here, let me tell it to you and we'll see what we do. A guy walks out the door, he's going to get into his car, and he gets hit by a car, and he's dead. And he gets up, you know, he kind of like comes to and realizes he's in hell. And he goes, oh my God, I'm going to be spending eternity in hell, this sucks. And Satan comes over and says, well, wait a minute. Do you like to eat? He goes, well, yeah, sure. Well, Mondays, you can eat anything you want. You can eat pork, prime rib. You don't have to worry about your cholesterol going up. You know, you don't have to worry about getting high blood pressure because you're dead. I goes, oh. Well, that doesn't sound too bad. Devil says to him, you like to drink? Well, yeah. Psh, you can drink gallons of whiskey on Tuesday. You can drink whatever you want. It doesn't matter. Your liver's not going to give out because, well, you're dead. The guy's like, hey, you know, this isn't sounding so bad. Well, let me ask you, you like to gamble? Yeah. Devil says to him, Wednesdays is Vegas night. Doesn't matter how much you spend, how much you win, how much you lose. You're not going to lose your house because you don't have one. You're dead. He goes, wow, this is sounding pretty good. I mean, I don't get it. The devil says, you like to do drugs. He goes, well, you know, every once in a while, you know. He goes, Thursday, Den of Iniquity night. You can do heroin, you can do meth, you can do coke. It doesn't matter what you do. You're not going to overdose because you're dead. He goes, wow, I think I'm really going to like it here. And the devil says to him, so, are you gay? And he goes, no. You're not going to like Fridays. It's a long joke, but it's a good payoff at the end.
Yeah, I think that might be a good one to close with.
Okay, well, let's close with that one. Thank you, Mark, for being on. Just so everyone knows, Mark is going to be a regular, making regular appearances on the show. And probably when I can't find anyone else to get on the show, because Mark always has something to talk about.
Yeah, if anybody, I've actually asked a few in a few different places, including on Facebook, if anyone has any ideas for shows, you know, feel free to send it to us and we can see what we can come up with.
Oh, yeah, that's right. We actually, we do have a Facebook page and we do have a fan page there with discussion areas. And, you know, we'll be posting information on like when a show goes up and all that. So we'll have that all there available for you. And, you know, basically, check us out.
I'm fucking Ozzy Osbourne, the Prince of fucking Darkness. Evil, evil, but fucking evil.
There can be only one Prince of Darkness.
And that would be me, Robert Adams.
You've been listening to KHBR, The Voice of Darkness. If you have any questions or comments, you can email them to us at khpr@keffer.org. Thank you for listening, and we hope that we've been able to bring about some change for you.